From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the KMLB studios in Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are very thankful for that support. In fact, we couldn't do without it. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, August 14th is the Jewish observance of Tish B'Av. Monday, Catholics celebrate the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and Thursday brings Raksha Bandhan for Hindus. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, the refugee Olympic team has inspired many viewers of the Summer Olympics in Rio. 10 athletes from 4 countries are competing in athletics, judo, and swimming. A record number of LGBT athletes are taking part as well. Reports put the number at 42. And Muslim women competing in traditional religious garb include a fencer for Team USA and Egyptian beach volleyball team members. While fighting to keep his Senate seat, Marco Rubio has declared that infection with the Zika virus is no justification for terminating a pregnancy. This past week, the former presidential candidate also spoke at Radical Anti-LGBT Rediscovering God in America event in Orlando, sponsored by Dominionist David Lane's American Renewal Project. Wooing this fringe of the conservative right, Donald Trump was also in attendance. Speaking of Trump, the GOP nominee delivered a formal economic address on Monday, interrupted 14 times by hecklers and protesters, a fact that was quickly drowned out by 50 top Republican officials denouncing the candidate's plans in a letter published in the New York Times. And that was quickly drowned out for the rest of the week by a comment Trump made on Tuesday that suggested armed violence against Hillary Clinton might be necessary should she win the election. What did it take to drown out that controversy? A claim on Wednesday that President Obama is the founder of the terror group ISIS. You know, November 8th has never seemed so far away. The parents of 2 Americans killed in Benghazi, Libya in 2012 have filed suit against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Notably, they are being represented by Washington attorney Larry Klayman, who has made a career out of all kinds of legal actions against the Clintons dating back over 20 years. On August 1st, Joe Biden officiated at a same-sex marriage ceremony between 2 longtime White House staff members. So far, 3 bishops have spoken out against the country's first Catholic vice president. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
We call it the Johnson Amendment, where you are just absolutely shunned if you're evangelical, if you want to talk religion. You lose your tax-exempt status. We put into the platform, we're going to get rid of that horrible Johnson Amendment.
Since the Johnson Amendment was added to the IRS code in 1954, tax-exempt charities, including religious institutions, have been forbidden from making political endorsements. Contrary to most of the rhetoric from the religious political right, this doesn't silence leaders or members of these organizations. All it does is prevent what would otherwise be tax dollars, in effect, subverted for the benefit of political campaigns. While the subject naturally excites activists, how prevalent is the practice in houses of worship across the country? On this week's show, I'll pose that question to Jessica Martinez of the Pew Research Center, which has just released a survey titled, Many Americans Hear Politics from the Pulpit.
These religious freedom laws are really just a way to discriminate against gay individuals, LGBT community. That's what they are about.
We've seen a steadily growing entrenchment of culture war issues in the language of faith and religious freedom. Inevitably, this gets reflected in the approaches the political parties take to both the issues and the language of liberty in terms of religion and morality. An insightful article headlined "Republicans, Democrats, and the Stakes for Religious Freedom" addresses the challenges of respecting both the Non-Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of our Constitution. The author is Charles Haynes, founding director of the Religious Freedom Center at the Newseum in Washington, D.C., where he serves as vice president, and he'll be with us to share his concerns. But first,
for 30-year-old Iftihaj Muhammad, identity is important. She's a Muslim woman, an African-American, and an Olympic fencer.
I feel like my hijab is liberating. It is a part of who I am.
The Summer Olympics, currently taking place in Brazil, are naturally attracting worldwide attention. Notably, female Muslim athletes are taking part wearing the traditional hijab. Joining me right now is Solma Sharif, co-founder of Shir Zanan, a media and advocacy platform for and about Muslim females in sports. Solma's welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Is the number of Muslim female athletes in this year's Summer Olympics higher than in past years, or are we just getting more focus on it?
No, it is higher because last Olympics, 2012 in London, was the first Olympic that all participating countries, including Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Brunei, had female participants in. And that was partially because of IOC's mandatory rules that all the participant countries, they had to bring the female athletes with them. So last Olympic and the three countries of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Brunei were the last countries to have a female athlete on their team.
So let's talk about the athletes who are participating. Do you know what percentage of them are wearing the hijab or other religious-oriented clothing?
We haven't conducted a formal research on that, so I don't have exact number. But I could just say perhaps 40% mm-hmm. wear hijab.
That's pretty high, isn't it?
For comparing the countries, so there are two scenarios in Muslim female athletes.
Mm-hmm.
One is the countries that don't enforce hijab, and participant athletes, they choose themselves. And that's from Egypt to even America, when now Iftihaj Fencer is participating in the Olympics with the hijab, and that's what she wants. Then we have the other scenario, which is the country is an Islamic country, and they force hijab mm-hmm. on their athletes, meaning, for example, for a country such as Iran, which is kind of liberal countries, mm-hmm. people, so they would not necessarily choose hijab, or they might, but that would be a personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the country, because of the constitution, no one without hijab can participate. So we have these two scenarios in Muslim world. And because of that, we have a majority of Muslim countries who wearing hijab is not part of their constitution, mm-hmm. but it's part of their culture. And then we have other countries that is part of their constitution that they have to wear hijab.
I think a question that many Olympics watchers have when they see athletes dressed in the hijab is, doesn't that make competing more difficult? So would you talk briefly about the realities of what it's like to participate wearing the hijab?
So we're talking about the most professional sports activity and games in the world. At that level, any little things can impact the score and the record. even if the fabric is lighter or heavier, what sort of fabric they use, and are they comfortable in it? Do they have enough room to breathe as the skin? So all of these are factors in the most professional scoring game. So one argues that, of course, this affects. But the other way that we need to look at it is for such countries such as Iran or any other countries that is mandatory and is part of their constitution, if we take athletes who wear hijab out of the game, we're basically limiting a huge number of athletes who mm-hmm. want to participate in it. So because of that, we cannot say, okay, if you're wearing hijab, you can't participate in the games, because that by itself would be discrimination. But in the professional world, it depends on each country to say, okay, should I put it open? Should I let the athletes choose or not? Which, to be honest, we're too far away from that part in the reality. You mm-hmm. know, we have so many countries that won't even question that, regardless of how much they earn or how much they score.
I understand and appreciate what you've just said as the backdrop for understanding that kind of participation. But I want to come back and ask, is it your opinion, or what do you hear from female athletes who are participating? Is there a physical detriment in them wearing the hijab?
It depends very much to the game that they're playing. For example, if Ibtihaj is a fencer, mm-hmm. for her, it's not as important effect on mm-hmm. her performance as compared, let's say, for example, for a swimmer or for a gymnast. For mm-hmm. example, in the last Olympics, 2012 in London, we had a kayak rower from Iran who, because of the humidity and the climate and the fabric that she was wearing for a long time outside participating in the match, as a result, she had skin diseases grow. You know, so it really changes based on the sport, which sports they participate. Mm-hmm. For some sports, it doesn't. For some sports, it's actually part against the law in the game. For example, karate, they can't wear hijab because they must have ear visible to the referee. Mm-hmm. So it really changes based on each sport.
I see. What are the challenges in promoting this particular set of athletes and athletics?
The biggest challenge that we face is there is a very thin line, and we have to carefully walk on that, because on one hand, we don't want to be part of the discrimination against Muslim communities. But then on the other hand, we don't want to participate in a repress mm-hmm. on the Muslim female, especially young girls. So the whole conversation regarding Muslim communities in European and Western countries right now, I would say the toughest part is on Muslims, on the actual Muslims, because mm-hmm. they have to find the middle ground and understand and project both sides.
So how important is it to have such visibility for female Muslim athletes at the Summer Olympic Games?
Oh, I would say it's extremely important. The biggest part and the most obvious part is because each one of these female athletes participating in Olympics, they become a role model for the younger girl, for the young female. And in the lack of media coverage or media projection in conservative countries, it's extremely important for young girls to see someone, a female, at that level and believe, and just believe that, oh, it's possible. I can do that. I can be a professional athlete. Mm-hmm. So it's very important for a young girl to see it and believe that she can.
Do you have much contact with the female athletes that you promote and that you cover?
Yes, we do. And as a matter of fact, we have a good group of ambassadors that we call them our Shirzanon ambassadors. And they are superstars of different countries in female sports. We have the first Saudi Arabia climber we have a Pakistani swimmer who's participating in Olympics. They are really superstars, and not only they represent Shirzanah, but also they get to know each other through Shirzanah and exchange experiences, the struggles, and get motivated by each other and continue to motivate younger generation. They very much promote each other's work. Mm-hmm. And for example, Kiran Khan, Pakistani swimmer that I just mentioned, mm-hmm. she has swimming schools that she teaches the younger females in Pakistan. And, you know, when they see and learn from Kiran, of course they believe that they can participate at Olympic level if they want and if they work hard. Mm-hmm. And Kiran by itself has such an amazing story, because in order to learn swimming and participate in it, she had to cut her hair short mm-hmm. and pretend she's a boy in order to continue. Mm-hmm. Or, for example, a first Saudi climber, it's fantastic what she says. She says, I wish to not be the first one. I wish there were someone else before me to do that. Mm-hmm. But now that she is stars, there won't be any more first, and they can be as normal and as professional.
So, Maz, would you tell us just a little bit about the vision of Shirzanah and where you're focusing your efforts, and particularly how listeners to our program can find out more information if they'd like to get involved?
So our website is www.shirzanan.org, S-H-I-R-Z-A-N-A-N. And Shirzanan is a Persian word meaning lionesses, female heroes. And the reason I chose this name is because it's just, I saw it firsthand that female athletes, they basically further complicated their life by choosing to participate in a sport, because a sport is just part of entertainment, but it's so professional that could be a force of economic improvement and effects in broader politics. So it's one, participating and doing exercises, but the other part is to decide to be a professional sports person, in either athletes, referee, business person. So the reason I chose this name was because of that, and they truly represent as heroes to me to choose to do that.
Soma Sharif is co-founder of Shirzanah, a media and advocacy platform for and about Muslim women in sport. A writer, journalist, broadcaster, Solmaz has worked on CNN, the BBC, and The Voice of America. This is a subject that is timely and important, and we really appreciate you being on State of Belief Radio to inform us more about what the good work you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
At its best, our political system serves as an expression of American values, both individual and collective. Far too often, however, values rhetoric, and with it, religious rhetoric, gets dragged into the kinds of conflicts that have led to political gridlock in recent years. What are the pitfalls, and what would it look like if both the right and left in this country adhered more closely to the intentions of the founders? Charles Haynes is the founding director of the Religious Freedom Center in Washington, D.C., and Charles recently addressed these issues in an article headlined "Republicans, Democrats, and the Stakes for Religious Freedom." Charles Haynes, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, it's so good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Your framing of both the problem and some ways to improve the situation, and both succinct and articulate, would you start by summarizing what both sides are getting wrong as you see it?
I think that both sides are cherry-picking, really, the First Amendment. And we need to do better than that, especially the religious liberty principles are two principles for one: freedom. You know, no establishment and free exercise equals liberty of conscience for every human being. So we can't really emphasize no establishment without taking into account freedom of conscience and protecting that. And we can't go over there and emphasize free exercise of religion, but not pay attention to the very condition that supports religious freedom, and that is separating church from state.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say on the left, sometimes there is a tone deafness to claims of conscience. Not whether these claims should win or not or prevail or, you know, that's a good discussion to have in each case. But just in the first place to say, you know, when people have a religious claim of conscience, we take it seriously in the United States. And sometimes I think on the left, for some good reasons, those claims are not being listened to as they should be. And on the other side, on the right, it seems to me that the Establishment Clause has been forgotten. And the Establishment Clause is what got folks on the right to the fortunate place they're in, to have a voice in the public square. I mean, if we didn't have this arrangement in separating church from state, you know, they would not have the freedom to participate in the public square as they do. And we are so fortunate in this country. It's probably the most important principle we've given to world civilization is to really have a government that is neutral among religions and between religion and non-religion. And I think on the right, that important condition for freedom of conscience has been neglected and forgotten.
Charles, would you say the problem has been getting worse in recent years?
Yes, I think that we are victims of the culture wars, as you know, Weldon. I mean, I think we, in shouting past one another in the culture wars, particularly over LGBT rights and religious freedom issues, that shouting match and that fight of state to state and nationally has really poisoned the well for talking about religious freedom in a way that can bring us together. And there's plenty of blame to go around. I would say that people who advocate for religious freedom but forget about the need to protect fundamental rights for all people, mm-hmm. including LGBT people, are partly responsible for this poisoning of the well. But at the same time, LGBT advocates need to keep in mind that as we uphold non-discrimination and struggle for full equality, we also need to protect religious conscience as far as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's blame to go around. But this is getting worse and worse because people are taking sides in a way that is, frankly, beginning to demonize the other side.
Not to be cynical, but how much of this is likely to be coming from deeply held convictions, and how much might be politically motivated manipulation?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it's a mix, of course, as it always is in the political arena. And I would say that many religious leaders and political leaders are taking advantage of this situation and beating the drum for their agenda, knowing that it's going to resonate with people on other levels. And so I think that is a very manipulative way to go and is harmful to religious freedom. So, yes, I think there's a lot of, unfortunately, using this moment. For example, the reaction against American Muslims and Islam in general is an opportunity for some who have long harbored an animus towards Islam and Muslims. This whole conversation is their opportunity to demonize Islam, even as they frame it as fighting against terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of taking advantage of this situation, and that's been dangerous for religious freedom.
My guest is Charles Haynes, Vice President at the Newseum and Founding Director of the Religious Freedom Center in Washington, D.C. In your article, you zero in on Islamophobia. You call it the great religious freedom test of our time. I wish you'd talk about that a little more in the context of both history and in today's political rhetoric.
Sure. I think it's important for Americans to remember their history and to know that when we are faced with a new challenge, and as certainly the growth of Islam in the United States, and especially in the context of this world situation where people are, in the name of Islam, doing terrible things, they are really anti-Muslims. It's the anti-Islamic state. But nevertheless, what they've done is given people fuel, ammunition in this country to demonize Islam and Muslims in the name of fighting terrorism, which is wrong. But the challenge comes when we're faced with this. How are we going to react as a people? We did badly, frankly, in the 19th century for decades in treating Catholics in a terrible way, with prejudice and discrimination, and, you know, passing laws to limit the freedoms, trying to limit the freedoms of Catholics, keep them from being citizens. I mean, convents were burned and riots, and, you know, it was a terrible time. We forget that. And that's not who we need to be now. And if we go through that all again and forget that we're the haven for the cause of conscience in the United States, we protect the rights of people, even those we deeply disagree with. That's, you know, on our best days, who we are. And we failed to do that in the past with Mormons and with Catholics, to a great extent with Jehovah's Witnesses, who've been to the Supreme Court more than 50 times to try to get their freedom protected. So, you know, we've had a struggle in this country to live up to this ideal of religious freedom for all, a level playing field for all. And suddenly, you know, American Muslims are being targeted, and we forget that when we do that, we do it for ourselves, because today it's Muslims or Sikhs or others. And tomorrow it could be our group that's targeted.
Charles, I read you as saying both political parties should be equally invested in preventing religious bigotry, even if only out of self-interest. Is that a fair interpretation?
Absolutely. Both parties say they're for religious freedom, but it's time now to be clear what religious freedom is and isn't. And to be for religious freedom and at the same time encourage Islamophobia. And I have to say that in the primary season on the Republican side, the Islamophobia coming from many candidates, not just Donald Trump, led to a spike in attacks on Muslims and on Muslim institutions in this country. This has been well documented. This is clear connection between rhetoric and speech and hate and actual damage to people's lives. So to be the party that stands for religious freedom, which is what the Republican Party says it is, they need to understand that's not just religious freedom for the Christians or the Christians they like. It's religious freedom for everyone, including faith groups that they disagree with or that they find offensive. The rights of all have to be defended. Now, on the Democratic side, of course, you know, there's a great emphasis on protecting the rights of American Muslims, and that's a good thing. But I think it also, there has to be sensitivity to the fact that many evangelicals, many conservative Christians of various kinds, feel they don't have a voice or a home on the Democratic side, and that's not right. Conscience is conscience, and it doesn't mean, again, that everybody wins their claim, but it means that we take them seriously. So I think the Democratic side needs to do much more to say, look, religious liberty, religious freedom is as important a principle to us as the other core principles we're standing for as a party.
Tell us about how the situation could get even worse if there's no concerted effort to make it better.
Well, I think the worst case scenario is that religious freedom becomes a code phrase for bigotry. And for many Americans already, that's becoming the case. If in some circles, if you say religious freedom or that you are part of the Religious Freedom Center, they immediately wonder whether you're out there to discriminate, to take away rights, to limit civil rights for people. That is really tragic. You know, so I think that's the worst case scenario. On the other side, the worst case scenario is that we move forward with the good things that we want to do, equality for all, particularly LGBT people, protecting rights, but we lose an investment in protecting our religious diversity, our role of faith in public life, being vigorous and welcome. That's not the country we want in the future. We don't want to kind of sanitize a religion-free zone public square. That's not America either. We're not France. We're not other countries where it's difficult to be religious in the public square. So, you know, the dangers on both sides are that we move away from the kind of country we want to be. I'm not saying we were ever this country mm-hmm. fully. It's a story. It's a struggle. But it's our vision. Our vision is a level playing field mm-hmm. for everybody. And the fear I have is that we're going to lose commitment to religious freedom because people are giving religious freedom a bad name. Mm-hmm. Religious freedom is not bigotry. It's not shouldn't be. Shouldn't be another way of discriminating. Can we uphold non-discrimination and also protect religious liberty? Mm-hmm. Absolutely we can do that. Mm-hmm. Will one side or the other win everything? No. But we have to sit together and figure out how we can do this together and try to live with one another across differences and uphold both principles.
In a social change movement of any kind, one of the strategies is stealing the vocabulary. Everybody's talking about the importance of religious freedom, but not everybody means the religious freedom the same way. How do we get back to the kind of religious freedom that we find in the United States Constitution and that has been a part of this nation for centuries so that we can say, I am for religious freedom as it's found in the Constitution, or I am against that? It would be better, in my view, if we said, we have a debate on what's right and what's wrong about this, rather than saying, we all believe in religious freedom.
Well, I think that we take a page from what Utah did not long ago. Not to say that's the model for everyone in this substance, but in the way they did it, the state of Utah, where the LDS Church, which is, of course, the prevailing religion in Utah, Equality Utah, which is the LGBT leading group in Utah, government officials who are very conservative Republicans by and large in the legislature, came together. They sat together. And they said, you know, we need to work this out. We're Americans. And the principles of religious liberty and non-discrimination are framing principles for us. Let's agree on these principles and find a way, if we can, to do this, work this out. So it's a real-life case study for how we could do this in different states. And they worked it out. And they got Utah Compromise is actually a really good example where you have a religious liberty bill that does a lot to protect religious liberty in Utah in a way that's peculiar to Utah mm-hmm. law, but nevertheless protects. And non-discrimination for LGBT people in housing and in the workplace, which is kind of basic, right?
Yeah.
So in other states, though, when they do these kinds of things, they fight. One side says, well, look, you know, we want religious freedom exemptions. We don't like same-sex marriage. We want religious freedom exemptions from this, this, and this. And then we're not going to pass any legislation to protect LGBT rights in housing or workplace. And we're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a non-starter, and that's not a religious freedom model. That's not an American model. And if that's the way the lines are drawn, then people are going to just increasingly stop supporting religious freedom. The American people are not going to buy, most of us are not going to support, you know, a zero-sum game where one side wins all. And on the other side, in so-called blue states, I mean, I think it's important when LGBT rights are affirmed and protected that they think, well, how can we make sure that where appropriate and possible, we protect religious conscience? Mm-hmm. Not in a way that would take away the rights of anyone, but how can we find ways to signal that we respect religious conscience? You know, I think Utah showed, which is a tough state to tackle this, they showed, you know, speaking together, working together, we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And the arrangement in religious freedom and the principles in the First Amendment are the best ground rules in the world for doing this. We just need to use them in a way that's fair and not as a bludgeon against the other side.
You know, the way you answered that question is precisely the reason that listeners to State of Belief Radio ought to know the Religious Freedom Center very well and appreciate what's going on in the museum there and the programs that are being sponsored by your creative and prophetic work. Just briefly, say a word or two about the programs at the Religious Freedom Center that might be helpful to voters as they get ready for November 8th.
Sure. Thank you, Weldon. That's very kind. We are at the museum, as people may know who visit Washington. We're right between the White House and the Capitol. And though we are a museum about the First Amendment and the five freedoms, we're also home to a number of centers. And the Religious Freedom Center is the growing, vibrant center here now, and we are doing many things that offering many resources for Americans to learn about all sides of these issues. So we, of course, don't litigate, we don't lobby, we don't take sides in the political arena, but we do educate, and we convene people from all sides. And we like to think of ourselves as honest brokers for these conversations. And so we offer on our website, religiousfreedomcenter.org, we offer a range of resources, consensus guidelines for how to deal with religion in public schools, the pamphlet we did with you, Weldon, What is the Truth About American Muslims, that Interfaith Alliance worked with us on, and just all a host of resources that people can use in their communities. We also offer courses. We're a school for religious freedom now, and for religious leaders in communities and for emerging religious leaders, people who or people of secular groups that want a grounding in religious freedom principles. We offer graduate-level courses. They are blended learning, so they are mostly online, and you can get credit through various institutions and seminaries and so forth. But the in-person part of 3 days here at the museum is really critical, because we bring together cohorts of people from many different faith traditions, some who have no religious affiliation, to learn from and with one another. So, we're very ambitious here. We think that for the long term, beyond the culture wars, beyond the November election, for the long term, we need to educate a future leadership about these founding principles that you've asked about and we've talked about during this time.
Charles Haynes is the founding director of the Religious Freedom Center at the museum in Washington, D.C., where he serves as vice president. His article headlined Republicans, Democrats, and the Stakes for Religious Freedom, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Charles, as always, it's great to visit with you. It's great to learn from you, and thank you for taking the time to be with us once more on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. It's such a privilege to always be with you, Weldon.
The headline of the new Pew Research Center survey is, Many Americans Hear Politics from the Pulpit. News articles reporting on this survey have highlighted both positive and negative aspects of the findings, so I thought it was important to get some highlights directly from Pew. Joining me now is Jessica Martinez, senior researcher. And Jessica, I welcome you back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, right off the bat, I'm encouraged that respondents to the survey seem to indicate that while political issues come up a lot in houses of worship, candidate endorsements are far more rare. What are the numbers on these two questions?
Yeah, that's right. So we find that among those who tell us that they have attended religious services during the past few months leading up to our survey, nearly two-thirds say that clergy at their place of worship spoke out about at least one of several political and social issues that we asked about, common among them being things like religious liberty and homosexuality. But far fewer say that they heard their clergy speak out directly either in support of or against a specific presidential candidate in the months leading up to the survey. So about 14% say they heard either one or the other clergy speaking out either in support or against a particular candidate.
Mm-hmm. What are the issues that Pew has flagged as political that people are hearing about from the pulpit?
Yeah, well, we asked about six different kinds of topics specifically and whether people were hearing about these kinds of things. And we found that about 4 in 10 recent churchgoers said that clergy had spoken out on the topics of religious liberty and homosexuality, and about 3 in 10 had heard about either abortion or immigration, and about 2 in 10 had heard about the environment or about economic inequality more broadly.
Do you sort those issues by ideology, meaning pro or con on a particular issue?
To some degree, yes. For each topic, we asked about, you know, sort of two different potential takes on it. And so we find that for the topic of religious liberty, people tend to hear what's often associated with a more conservative perspective these days, in that they hear clergy speaking out in defense of religious liberty. About a third of all recent churchgoers said that they had heard this kind of talk at church, and very few heard another side where clergy are saying they don't think that religious liberty is under attack to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for abortion. They hear the much more conservative position with clergy speaking out against abortion far more often than they say they hear about clergy speaking out in support of abortion rights. When it comes to the topics of immigration or the environment, people tend to hear what might be thought of as the more traditionally liberal perspectives much more often. So one in five or so heard clergy speak out about the need to be welcoming and supportive of immigrants, versus only about 4% who said they heard clergy say we need stricter immigration enforcement, or a similar share who said they heard both kinds of perspectives. And similar kind of pattern when it comes to the environment. More people heard clergy speaking out about the need to protect the environment than speaking out against environmental regulations.
Jessica, how about endorsement or criticism of individual candidates? What are the differences among different demographic groups?
So it's overall a relatively small share, about 1 in 10 who heard clergy speak out in support of a candidate, and roughly the same share who heard clergy speak out against a candidate. But we find it somewhat more common among Black Protestant churchgoers. Close to 3 in 10 said they had heard clergy speak out in support of a candidate, and the same share had heard clergy speak out against a particular candidate. And that compares with roughly 1 or 10 or fewer among white evangelical or white mainline Protestant churchgoers, or among Catholic churchgoers as well.
Did you see any surprise among yourselves, given the tenor of the campaign this year and all of the negation directed at Donald Trump, that those are more equal than I would have expected them to be?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. If you look overall at all the people who said they had recently attended services, though it's a, you know, a small share who heard either support or opposition to a candidate, it tends to be the case that it's more common for people to hear clergy speak out in support of Hillary Clinton than in support of Donald Trump. About 6% of all mm-hmm. churchgoers said they heard support for Clinton versus mm-hmm. 1% for Trump. And on the other side, it's just a slightly higher share who heard clergy speak out against Trump than heard them speak out against Clinton. So 7% of all recent churchgoers said they heard clergy speaking out against Trump, and 4% against Clinton. So, you know, it's fairly small shares, mm-hmm. but you're hearing a little bit more opposition to Trump and a little bit more support for Clinton in churches where these kinds of conversations are taking place.
I want to go back to the subject of religious liberty. I would like for you to talk about some of the findings regarding how common that subject is and among which groups you find it.
Yeah, so among all of the respondents who said they had recently attended worship services, 4 in 10 said that they had heard clergy at their places of worship speaking out about the topic of religious liberty in recent months. And it was particularly common among white evangelical churchgoers. So fully half, 52%, had heard the topic come up. And that included 45% who heard clergy speak out in defense of religious liberty. And so this was somewhat higher than among some other groups like mainline Protestants or Black Protestants. About a third of Catholics had also heard their clergy speaking out in defense of liberty in Mass in the previous few months leading up to the survey.
I'm pleased to see that clergy generally is encouraging congregational members to vote without endorsing any particular candidate or party. How prevalent is that?
Yeah, so we found that in the, you know, the months of spring and early summer in the campaign so far, about a third of recent churchgoers said that they had heard clergy encourage the congregation to either vote in a primary or participate in a caucus early on in the process. Mm-hmm. And 4 in 10 had already heard clergy encouraging people to vote in the general election for president this fall. So many people hearing about the election so far in the campaign.
And you see that across the board of black churches, white churches, Christian, non-Christian, all of that?
Yeah, when it comes to participation in the primary process, black Protestants were particularly likely to have heard clergy encouraging their participation. About half said this, compared to roughly a third of white evangelicals and a quarter of Catholics. When it comes to voting in the general election, again, we see a lot of black Protestant churchgoers saying their clergy have spoken out about this, about 6 in 10, but also close to half of white evangelical Protestant churchgoers, a third of Catholics, and about a quarter of white mainline Protestants.
Mm-hmm. I really am pleased that you did this, because I think this information is terribly important for those of us in the religious community, understanding the behavior and trends that go on in houses of worship. Are you and your colleagues, I don't know whether you all do this or not, but when you put together the data that you're sharing here, and you have a long history of doing not this particular survey, but other values surveys, were there any surprises that you found in doing this survey?
It's the first time we asked these specific questions, mm-hmm. so it was hard to know exactly what to expect, but it's certainly interesting to find that so many people had been hearing about, you know, one or more of these issues so far in this year's campaign, and definitely interesting to find that so many people have already heard clergy encouraging folks to get out and vote throughout the spring and early summer when we're getting a little closer to fall, but still early in the campaign, people are hearing quite a bit about the election. So that was definitely interesting to see.
Jessica Martinez is senior researcher at Pew Research Center. She's one of the contributors to the new survey headlined "Many Americans Hear Politics from the Pulpit." The results are available online, and we'll link to them from stateofbelief.com. Jessica, thanks again for being with us, and we'll talk with you again soon, we hope.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share that with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. And let me just say, we're so pleased with the way many, many of you have turned to the work we did during both of the political conventions and how you have responded to our work in providing information on that. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.